Acts chapter 17, we're making our way through the book of Acts. And, you know, one of the sports that I like to watch, and baseball is the kind of sport where, you know, it's, you know, you hit the highlights on TV, watching a baseball game on TV, it's okay. But man, being there in person, watching a baseball game, I've been to Wrigley Field, I've been to Kaminsky Park, I've been to Turner Field. When you're there and you're watching the Braves play, I mean, it's just a whole different experience than watching it on TV. I love being at a ball game and watching baseball just like in person. That's what I really enjoy. And one of the most interesting players in baseball is something called a switch hitter. Now, a lot of you know what a switch hitter is. A switch hitter is someone that could hit from either side of the batter's box. Doesn't matter what side. They can hit right-handed. They can hit left-handed. If the situation calls for them to hit right-handed, they'll hit right-handed. If it calls for them to hit left-handed, they'll hit left-handed. The player doesn't change. The goal doesn't change. But the approach they use changes depending on the situation. And when I read Acts chapter 17, that's what I see in the Apostle Paul. I see Paul switch hit when it comes to evangelism. I mean, you take Paul and you put him in a synagogue surrounded by Jews who know the Old Testament, he can point them to Jesus. But then you can also take Paul and you could put Paul in Athens. And you can surround him by pagan philosophers who don't know Moses, who don't know Isaiah, who don't know Abraham, who don't accept the authority of Scripture, and Paul can reach them too. Paul was an ambidextrous evangelist. He could switch it. He could go into the houses of religion and witness to religious people, but then he could also go into the marketplace and witness to the common folks, but then he could also go to the lecterns and witness to the intellectuals and the philosophers and the skeptics. Paul could do it all. Paul's one of the most versatile evangelists in the New Testament. Now, when I say the word evangelist, I'm not talking about a pastor that comes to a church and preaches for a week. I'm talking about the responsibility of each and every one of us to become an evangelist. It is the responsibility of every Christian to become an evangelist. And Paul was one of the best at it. And what I want to do this morning is I want to look at how Paul evangelized the city of Athens. And I want to take some lessons from how Paul evangelized Athens that we can learn to evangelize the people around us. Now, remember, the city of Athens in Paul's day was a great city. It was a pagan city. It was a pluralistic city. It was said during that time, during Paul's time, that in the city they had more than 3,000 statues and temples to various gods. Now, there is one primary god in Athens, and it's the goddess that the city is named after, and it is the goddess Athena. And I'm going to show you a picture in a minute. They built a building called the Parthenon, and it was the temple to Athena. Athena was the goddess of war and wisdom and protection. And we know that building today as the Parthenon. Athens was considered the intellectual center of the ancient world. Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, all of them came from Athens. In fact, Plato established the first institute of higher learning in 387 BC, and he called it the Academy of Athens. Now, let me show you a picture of the Parthenon. This is the Parthenon. It measures 228 feet by 101 feet. It was completed in 438 BC. It's an architectural wonder because the columns and the roof lines of the Parthenon, they were designed concave. So at a distance, there's an optical illusion that it looked perfectly straight at a distance. And that's the reason why they did that. Now, 50 yards away from the Parthenon was another temple. Show the next slide. The temple's not there anymore, but there was this little hill. And on this little hill stood another temple to the god of war, Ares. Okay? Now, the Roman counterpart to Ares was Mars. For the Romans, so Ares was the god of war for the Greeks. For the Romans, the god of war was Mars. Hence, we get the name Mars Hill. That's where that comes from. And that right there, that is Mars Hill. Now, we have some of the same questions today that Paul had in his day. How do we engage a religiously pluralistic society? I mean, everywhere you look, there's a different religion. Even people that say they worship Jesus, they don't worship the same Jesus that me and you worship, okay? So Paul shows us how to engage a skeptical society. Paul shows us how to engage a secular society. He shows us how to engage an intelligent yet biblically illiterate society. There are educated people. There are learned people. There are people with degrees and letters after their name. And they, when it comes to the Bible, they don't know anything about it. Take, for instance, Jeopardy. Anytime there's a Bible category on Jeopardy, we start chomping our bits and chomping our feet, and we start getting ready. Oh, I'm going to answer all these. I'm going to get double Jeopardy on this one. And you have these people that stand up, and they've already won thousands of dollars, and they've answered questions on history and literature and science and politics and culture. And then the Bible question comes up, who built the ark? And no one knows the answer to it. That's the kind, they're not unintelligent people. They're highly educated. They're highly capable, but they're biblically illiterate. That's all around us today. That's where we live at. That's the world we live in today. We cannot assume that people know who Abraham is. We can't assume that people understand sin, salvation, and the resurrection. And we can't even understand people really know who Jesus is other than some dude that lived a long time ago. Okay? So as we think about Paul this morning in Athens, I want you to think about four things this morning. When Paul was in Athens, I want you to think about what he saw, what he felt, where he went, and what he said. So what I want you to think about Paul being in Athens, we're going to answer those four questions. What did Paul see? What did Paul feel? Where did Paul go? And what did Paul say? So without further ado, let's jump into our message and tackle the first one. What Paul saw. What Paul saw. So verse 16 starts out, "Now while Paul was waiting for them in Athens." Let's stop there. If you back up into verse 13 in this chapter, Paul is in Berea. He's in Berea and agitators come. And so they take Paul and they escort him to Athens to get him away from the agitators. So this wasn't a planned trip. This wasn't a planned missionary trip. He wasn't planning on going to Athens turn into a mission trip. That wasn't the plan. That wasn't on the agenda. But here's the thing about Paul. Everywhere Paul goes, he's a missionary. So whether it was a mission trip or not, Paul is there, and he's a missionary, and he's going to evangelize. Paul evangelized wherever he went. Okay, so let's continue reading verse 16. "Now while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, his spirit was being provoked within him as he observed the city was full of idols." One commentator says that it was easier to find an idol in Athens than it was to find another person. Okay, so if you grew up, so just think about Paul walking down the street, and the streets are lined both sides with idols up and down the street. Now, if you grew up in Athens, that it's nothing to you. It blends into the background. You've seen them all your life. You're used to them. You're used to seeing these idols lining the streets. But if you're Paul, if you're Christian, you immediately think, whoa, something's wrong here. You know, one of the things that I used to love to do, I used to love to go into Lifeway bookstores. Y'all remember the Lifeway stores. I mean the actual physical store. I used to love to go into Lifeway stores. I would go into Lifeway stores and I would walk around for hours just in a Lifeway store. Now, I never bought anything, so I'm one of the reasons why why they shut down, because I would go in there most of the times and just look and I wouldn't actually buy anything, so they had to shut them down. But now I go to Books A Million, I go to Barnes & Noble, and you know me, preacher, I make a beeline for the religion section. And, you know, I've noticed things about those religious sections. They're getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And even the stuff they put in the religion section really shouldn't be in there. But as you're walking through these stores and you see the titles of some of these books, something seems off. Some of the titles of these books are, you know, believe in yourself, trust in yourself, follow your heart, find the power within you. You might not notice it as a regular person, but when you're a Christian, and when you look at life with a Christian worldview, and when you look at life in the light of God's revelation, you hear these things and something's off. See, my Christian worldview tells me my heart is desperately wicked. Who can know it? My Christian worldview tells me my feelings don't determine truth. That's what my Christian worldview tells me. So while everybody else is walking down the street and it's business as usual and it's nothing out of the ordinary for them, Paul walks down the street and says, whoa, something's bad wrong here. Something's way off. Christians, we wear different glasses than the rest of the world. We have a Christian worldview. We see things through the light of God's revelation. So just like Paul, when we scroll Facebook or we walk through the town center or we walk through the mall or we watch TV or we listen to the news, or we can see idolatry everywhere that the natural man can't see. The natural man can't catch it. But because we're Christians, we see this idolatry everywhere in our world. It was Chesterton that said, when man ceases to worship God, he doesn't worship nothing. He worships everything. And so when he saw these idols, what happened? He felt something. He saw something, and then he felt something. So next we're going to talk about what Paul felt. So back to verse 16. Now, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, his spirit was being provoked within him. Now, that word provoked is a very strong word. If you read your Old Testament, you'll see that word provoked in your Old Testament a lot. Because throughout your Old Testament, as you read it, you're going to see that the idolatry of the Israelites provoked the Lord to anger. Okay? So Paul is the same way. He's being provoked. He has an anger. He has a certain anger. He has a certain religious indignation, righteous indignation. He has a zeal for God's glory. Paul doesn't want these idols worshipped in Athens. Paul wants Jesus worshipped in Athens. Paul has the same feeling as the psalmist who wrote Psalm 67, where he said, may the people praise you. May all the peoples praise you, God. But you can tell that Paul also has a love for the Athenians. Let's go back to the Old Testament. These idols that the Israelites were worshiping provoked God to anger. Why was he provoked to anger? Because he loved them. If he didn't love them, he wouldn't care. If he didn't love them, he wouldn't get angry. But he got angry because he had a love for them. They were his chosen people. Of course, he loved them. So Paul not only had a zeal for God, had a zeal for the glory of God, but Paul had a broken heart. He had a compassion for these people from Athens. A parent who does not correct their child does not love their child as much as they love themselves. A spoiled child equals a selfish parent. Okay? Because listen, no mom and dad loves correcting their children. It's hard for us to do. You know, my parents used to say it hurts me more than it hurts you. I was like, yeah, right. Why don't we switch places then? Okay. But then you become a parent, and it really does hurt. It really does hurt to have to correct your child. But if you love them more than you love yourself, you will correct them. You won't be selfish about it. That's the problem that we have when it comes to evangelism. It's a heart problem. We don't tell people the truth of the gospel because we don't love them. And in fact, this is a truth. Many Christians simply don't care. They simply don't care. But that's not Paul. He's wandering around the city, and he's provoked by what he sees. And that causes him to go somewhere, and it causes him to say something. So now, next, let's talk about where Paul goes. Where Paul goes. Paul goes to three places. He goes to the synagogue. He goes to the marketplace to talk to the common people. And then he goes to Mars Hill to address the skeptics and the philosophers. This reflects our nation. Okay, there are some places you can go in our nation where people are intellectually smart, but they know next to nothing about the Bible. But yet there are still other places you can go and everybody's saved. Everybody you ask, they're all saved. They're all religious, but they're not really Christians because they don't have an understanding of the gospel. In fact, it's very popular today to be hostile toward Christianity. So wherever you go in our nation, you're going to run in one of those two places. You're either going to go to a synagogue area where people are religious but lost, or you're going to go to a marketplace area where people are apathetic or even hostile toward Christianity. Paul went to both places. Let's see what he did. Verse 17. So he was reasoning in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be present. Now listen, there's not a lot of information here about what he did in the synagogue, but we've been in Acts all year. We know how Paul works. What Paul does when he enters a new city. In fact, he did it at the beginning of this chapter. You can go back to verses 2 and 3 of Acts 17, and it says, "And according to Paul's custom, he visited them for three Sabbaths, reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and giving evidence that the Christ had to suffer and rise from the dead, and saying, 'This Jesus who I am proclaiming to you is the Christ.'" So this was Paul's custom. This was Paul's habit. He would go to the Jews first, and he would take his knowledge of prophecy in the Old Testament, and he would prove to them from the Scriptures that Jesus was the Christ that was to come. Okay? Sometimes he would have bad results. Sometimes he'd have people follow him, but that's what he always did. So he could reach people in religious settings. Now let me say this. I know not everyone in this room is a preacher. But whether you preach or whether you teach or any capacity you volunteer in any ministry in the church, make sure every week, every time you teach, it's rooted in the gospel. You can't assume that everybody that comes to church is a Christian. You can't do that. It doesn't matter if we've got a church full of home folks and no visitors and just people that's been coming here for years. You still can't assume that everybody that comes to church is a Christian. You have to make the gospel available. That's in youth ministry. That's in children's ministry. That's in vacation Bible school. Anything you volunteer for, you make the gospel a priority. So that's what Paul did in the synagogue. Now let's see what he does in the marketplace. Paul goes into the marketplace, and he starts a conversation. Every church needs marketplace ministries. Evangelism cannot be just contained inside the building of the church. It can't exist just in the building. Evangelism has to go outside the building. And evangelism isn't just for pastors and deacons and Sunday school teachers. Evangelism is for everybody. Each and every one of us are called to be evangelists. It used to be that church could have a really good program and people would come in. Well, our society is changing. Our world is changing. I'm not coming in that much anymore. Field of Dreams is a good movie. It's a bad evangelism strategy. If you build it, they will come. When it comes to evangelism, no, they won't. You have to go into the workplace. You have to go into the neighborhoods. You have to find a way to go into the marketplace. And listen, I'm preaching this to myself as much as I'm preaching it to you. I think we've grown complacent in our churches today, and it's time we start thinking outside the box. Now listen, Christianity is not the center of our culture anymore. Christian, we're on the fringes. We're on the margins. Christianity is on the outside looking in. Statistics say that 85 million people in America have no intention of attending a church service. In the UK, that number is 40 million, but that's 70% of the population. Since 1991, the number of people who don't attend church has doubled since 1991. So what do we do in a secular world? We got to start engaging people. We got to start learning conversation skills. We have to put the phones down, and we got to start talking to people. In fact, put verse 17 back up there. In verse 17, that top word there, reasoning, that word reasoning, where he reasoned to the people in the synagogue and he reasoned to the people in the marketplace. In the Greek, that's the word dialogamai. Dialogamai is where we get the word dialogue from. It's a back and forth. And really, it's just simply asking questions. You know why a lot of people don't engage people in evangelism? Because it's like, I don't have all the answers. That's okay. You don't have to have all the answers. You just got to ask some questions. You just got to you got to ask some good questions to get a back and forth going. You don't have to have all the answers. Just ask some good questions. In verse 18, he engages with the philosophers. They're called the Epicureans and the Stoics. Here's the easiest explanation for the Epicureans and the Stoics. The Epicureans said, find peace through pleasure. The Stoics said, find peace through self-control. But Paul said, you find peace, real peace, through Jesus Christ and Jesus Christ alone. And they also, in this passage, they call Paul a scavenger of tidbits. And what they're accusing Paul of is cherry-picking truths, but not having a coherent thought. So while still in the marketplace, they bring him over to the Areopagus. They bring him over to Mars Hill, say, okay, Paul, we want to hear you out. What do you have to say for yourself? So finally this morning, we're going to talk about what Paul said. Now, this isn't a sermon as much as it's kind of like a college lecture. They didn't sing a hymn before Paul started speaking. Okay, remember, this is a pagan marketplace setting. And this is the outline that Paul gives to them. And really, it's the outline of the whole Bible. Paul starts with creation, and he ends with final judgment. Okay? Verse 22. So Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, men of Athens, I see that you are very religious in all aspects. For while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I also found an altar with this inscription. To an unknown God. Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, I proclaim to you. It's like I told these children up here. The Greeks had a God for everything you could imagine. God for this, God for that, God for this, God for that. And they had gods for everything. And just in case they missed one, they had a statue that was dedicated to the unknown God. So Paul says, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to reveal to you the identity of the unknown God. I want to make the unknown God knowable to you. So in the synagogue, he probably started with Abraham. And the marketplace, he started with this inscription on an idol. But in both places, he ended with the resurrection. Verse 24. The God who made the world and everything that is in it, since he is the Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temple made by hands. So he starts with creation. God made everything. That flies in the face of Greek religion because they had a God for everything. And Paul said, no, there's one God, and that one God made everything. He created everything under the sun. Even though today, basically, everything's made in China. In my office, I have a figurine. It's an eagle figurine standing on top of an American flag. It's an American flag that I bought in Nicaragua, and it was made in China. Everything's made in China. But you know what? Really, everything on this whole planet has a stamp on it, made by God. Everything was made by God. Put the Parthenon back up there for me. So he's standing there in the shadow of this building, and there are people that he's talking to who've probably never in their life seen something that big. That's probably the biggest thing, man-made thing they'd ever seen in their life. And Paul looked at them and said, God is so big, you can't contain him even in that building. The God I'm telling you about would not fit in that building right there. You can't contain him in that building. Verse 25. Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. Paul says God doesn't need us. We need him. If you remember Elijah mocking the prophets of Baal, Elijah was so sarcastic, I love it. I mean, Elijah let him have it. Maybe your God's on a journey. Maybe he's asleep. Maybe he's eating. Oh, and this was the best one. Maybe your God's using the bathroom. Elijah let him have it, okay? But let me tell you something about our God. Our God never takes a journey. Our God never sleeps. Our God doesn't need food. Our God doesn't need air. He's entirely self-sufficient. And he is also sustaining everything. Right now, God's hand is in your chest, pumping your heart. You're breathing right now. The blood's flowing through your veins. Because God has his invisible hand in your chest right now, pumping your heart. God is the sustainer of all things. Verse 26. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation. He made every race. Diversity is God's idea. He's sovereign over history. He's sovereign over geography. So he's creator. He's sustainer. He's a ruler of nations. Verse 27. That they would seek God if perhaps they might feel around for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. So Paul kind of hints at sin here. He says that people are reaching out, trying to find God, but they can't because they're blinded. And when you're blinded by sin, the only person who can open your eyes is God himself. Verse 28, for in him we live and move and exist, even as some of your own poets have said, for we also are his descendants. Therefore, since we are descendants of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by human skill and thought. Paul is saying, if we are made in the image of God, how can we think we could ever worship anything made by our own hands? That's not how it works. How could we be made in the image of God and then worship something that we made? What he is saying is don't worship created things. Worship the Creator God. Verse 30. This is where he ends with final judgment. So having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now proclaiming to mankind that all people everywhere are to repent, because he has set a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom he has appointed, having furnished proof to all people by raising him from the dead. Paul is saying, So far, God has been patient in judgment in his mercy. But something has changed. Something is now different. And what's different now is that Christ has come. And then Paul calls him to repentance for their sin. He is talking to the Epicureans and the Stoics. He's talking to philosophers who believe this. These philosophers believe that all of creation, that all the universe goes through cycles of chaos and order. Endless, like history's not going anywhere. Like history has no destination. Everything is just a cycle. This was Greek philosophical thought. That everything is just cycles of chaos and order, chaos and order, chaos and order, going on infinitely, not going anywhere. History isn't going anywhere in particular. Paul says you're wrong. History is going somewhere. History is moving toward one day. And on that day, the judge will appear. And the man that God has appointed as that judge is Jesus Christ. And the proof I have of this is the resurrection, is the empty tomb. And what Paul is telling them is he's telling them, if you repent, then he won't be your judge. Instead, he'll be your Savior. Now, that's what he said. Now, very quickly, to end this out, I'm going to give you four quick reflections that won't be very long. Four quick reflections on what Paul did in Athens. First, I want you to notice Paul's consistency. Paul's consistency. Everywhere Paul went, he had on his mind sharing the gospel, whether it's in a synagogue or the marketplace. The gospel was on his mind everywhere he went, okay? He was consistent. May we have that kind of consistency in our own evangelism. Next, I want you to notice his comprehensiveness. When you deal with someone that doesn't know anything at the anything about the Bible, you don't start with you're a sinner. You go back, you go back to creation. That's where you start. You go creation, fall, Christ, his work, his resurrection, final judgment. You cover the whole scope. This is when you're talking to somebody that doesn't know anything about the Bible, you have to go back to creation and work from there. So he was comprehensive. Then I want you to notice his contextualization, okay? When he was in the synagogue, he used the prophecy of the Old Testament to connect to the Jews. When he was in the marketplace and on Mars Hill, he used the statue of the unknown God to connect to his audience. If you're going to share the gospel with someone, you've got to find a way to connect with them. Okay, friends, you talk to a 9-year-old different than you talk to a teenager, but you're giving them the same gospel. Paul here is quoting Greek poets to the philosophers. He's actually quoting Greek poets to them. Paul's not endorsing their culture, but he's engaging in their culture. Sometimes on a Sunday morning, I'll preach a sermon and I'll make a movie reference. Or pop culture reference. I mean, I can tell some of y'all don't like that at all. But I can see in the face of some of the younger people that they caught it. And they talked to me about it afterwards or later in the week. And what I did is I made a connection. I got this tattoo in Israel earlier this year. I can't tell you how many conversations that I've started. And how many conversations I've steered toward church and the gospel because of that, having that tattoo right there. I'll be honest with you. You can believe me or not. But I see somebody else with a tattoo say, hey, I like that. Let me show you mine. And it opens up a conversation. And we start having, that's just an example. You can use anything to connect with someone. Whether it be a ball team, the Ole Miss game, whatever it is. The tires, the mud grips on somebody's truck, something just to connect with them. Because that's what Paul is doing here. He's not endorsing their culture. He's engaging their culture. And what he's saying is, I understand your world enough to build a bridge from your world to the one you need to know. And the last thing you need is courage. It took courage for Paul to declare that Jesus is the only God and the only way. It took courage to preach that Jesus rose from the dead. It took courage to preach that they're going to be judged one day. Now, let's see how they responded. Look at verse 32. Now, when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some began to scoff, but others said, "We shall hear from you again concerning this." So Paul went out from among them, but some men joined him and believed. There were three responses. Some people mocked. Some people said, "Paul, you need to be patient with me. I need more time." But a seed was planted that could be harvested down the road. And some people believed. When me and you evangelize, remember, our goal is to tell them the truth. What they do with the truth is their responsibility, not yours. It's our job to simply tell them. You're going to have those same responses. They're going to mock you and hate you, slam the door in your face, hang the phone up on you, say they never want to talk to you again. They're going to mock you. Two, they're going to say, "Okay, but I'm not ready yet. Give me more time." Or they're going to believe and place their faith in Jesus. Those are the responses we're going to get. So from this passage, here's what I want you to see. I want you to see that the world is beautiful, but the world is broken, and it's full of lost people. What should we feel? We should feel that we want Jesus to be worshiped everywhere. Where should we go? Everywhere. Religious places, secular places, go everywhere. And what should we say? The gospel. Start with creation, end with judgment. Jesus, he's the only way. He's the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh to the Father but by Jesus. Every head bowed, every eye closed. Thank you for watching and being with us today. We're so glad you joined us, and we invite you to come back and join us next week.